This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. We're going to do something special today. We're going to talk about accumulating wealth. We're calling it Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? We'll tell you more about that later on in the program. And we're also going to talk about compounding income when you retire. And so let me just say this. If you're listening to this program, if you have children or you have grandchildren, I'm going to want you to have them listen to this podcast because it's very, very important when you take a look at what's going to happen with how they plan for their retirement, and especially if they can start planning at an earlier age. And we're going to tell you how this can almost be painless.
When it comes to talking about retirement, Jim, I know that you and I have talked quite a bit over the past several podcasts about investing in your 401k plan. And coming up later on the program, you'll be discussing this a little bit more with Veronica Dagher from the Wall Street Journal and the Dow Jones Publications Group. She's going to be talking with you about 401k boo-boos, essentially do's and don'ts for your 401k plan. That's coming up later on in the program today.
All right. Well, you've all heard Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And in fact, I think it was a TV show or a series. And so what I wanted to do today is I wanted to say, all right, let's say that at age 65, when you retire, we're going to set a round number and just say that you want to have $1 million saved up, whether it's in your 401k plan, your profit sharing plan, a pension, or a combination of what you have in your pension or personally, but we wanted to take $1 million. So we took $1 million, it's a round figure, you can break this down to 500,000 or let's say 100,000, but I think $1 million is a nice round figure. So what I wanted to do is, if you were to start saving, what I want to do is drive home the difference of how little it would take the sooner that you start saving. So what we did is we took four age groups. Somebody that started saving for their retirement at age 25, 10 years later at age 35, age 45, and age 55. And this, folks, I think you're going to find shocking. Now, what I wanted to do is also take a look at investment returns. Now, if we take a look at the last century, the last 100 years, the last 50 years, the stock market is compounded at over 10% a year. So I wanted to take a look at what would you get if you compounded at 10%, what would you get at 8%, and what would you get at 7%. So we wanted to take different rates of return because people are different. People have maybe more money allocated to fixed income. Some people might have more money towards stocks. But, you know, look, if you're at age 25 and you've got 40 years ahead of you to save for retirement, you're better off going for growth, especially in your early years when you have decades ahead of you to accumulate for retirement. And Kathleen, the numbers are just absolutely staggering.
What I find really fascinating, Jim, is that the difference between starting to invest for your retirement at age 25 and even the difference between that and age 35, just a mere 10 years later, is pretty significant. When you calculated how much a person would need to start saving every month at age 25 to save $1 million by retirement, assuming a 10% compounding return, if they start saving at age 25, they can save $158 a month and they'll reach that $1 million figure by the age 65. But if they wait to start saving just for 10 years more, they don't start saving for retirement until they're 35, they'd have to put away $440 a month, compounding at 10% to reach that $1 million figure. That's a pretty significant monthly difference there, Jim. That's over $200 difference.
Yeah, and the other difference too, Kathleen, is a lot of people are saying, you know, when we first got married, our first objective was to have a house, then it was putting away money for college, and we're going to address that here shortly. And then also, let's say, start putting money away for retirement. A lot of people really don't get serious about putting money away for retirement until they get into their late 40s or sometimes their 50s. And just as you mentioned, at age 25, folks, This is something I want your kids and your grandchildren to hear. At age 25, all it takes is about $158 a month at a 10% return. They'll have $1 million at retirement. As Kathleen just mentioned, you wait 10 years later, the number goes to 440. Now brace yourself. What happens if you wait till you're age 45? You have to put aside $1,320 a month. And if you wait till you're age 55, you have to put almost $4,900 a month to reach that retirement goal of having $1 million. It is so easy to do this at age 25. I mean, you know, Kathleen, most people get out of college, they start work. Most companies, I don't care, even if you work for the government, they have a 457 program. If you're a teacher in the education system, they have a 403b plan. And at age 25, you start work, you put $158, you're probably not even going to notice it. It's taken out of your paycheck. You invest it, you do it consistently, you're basically dollar cost averaging. But, you know, talk about a difference. $158 at age 25 versus $1,320 a month at age 45, or even worse, $4,900 a month at age 55. I mean, that is really a significant difference.
Well, Jim, when you think about the amount of income that you would have to be making to be able to put away almost $5,000 a month into retirement savings at 55, you'd have to be pretty high up there on the CEO scale to be earning an income that was high enough to put away that kind of money towards retirement at 55. You know, I was thinking, even when you graduate from college and you're earning your first paycheck, you know, you're not making a ton of money, but $158 a month typically should be less than 10% of your overall paycheck. So it shouldn't be that hard to put away at least 10% of your overall income every month into some kind of retirement savings.
No, I mean, if you think about it, let's just round it off to, let's say, $160. That's about $40. So maybe, you know, what you do is you cut out going out to dinner one night out of the week or something. You know, everybody could probably find $40 a week. Let's boil that $160 a month down to what it is a week. In $40, Kathleen, you know, most people, if they became disciplined and just told their employer, you know, just take it out, I want it going into the 401k program, they probably wouldn't notice it. Just like, you know, most people just take a look at their check and they look at the net number after you take out Social Security, federal and state tax withholding. So if you can become disciplined and you can do that at an early age, you know what? You'll probably never notice it. And by the way, you don't have to increase it later on when you have, let's say, you're saving for a house, you're trying to put money away for your kids' education, or, you know, their weddings if you have girls. And so that's the key thing. If you start out early, you don't have to change that number. That number will even get better if you, let's say, as you rise in your field and your income starts to go up, you start adding more. But literally, you could start out at $160 a month, never change it for the rest of life, and you'll end up being a millionaire by the time you retire.
When you think about that, Jim, you broke that down to $40 a week. If you were to have a really bad Starbucks addiction problem, and you just cut out your Starbucks coffee every day, you'd pretty much reach that $160 a month figure just from cutting out your Starbucks coffee.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's something that you can find in your budget. And that is the point we're trying to make here. It's the they call it the seventh wonder of the world. It's compounding. And if you can compound your wealth over a longer period of time, and it just, the numbers start to become astronomical. And like I said, you know, who would think that, you know, 40 bucks a week at age 25, you'd end up to be a millionaire at age, let's say, 65. And that's the key. The sooner that you start, the less money that you have to put away.
So, Jim, the bottom line here really is a combination of two really important things. We're talking about time, starting early, because the later you start, the more you have to contribute per month to reach a good retirement savings goal. And the other thing is a good rate of return. You know, you and I have been talking about the 10% annualized return on your investment. What about if you're only able to make 7% on your money? What kind of a difference would that make in terms of your amount you'd have to save for retirement, Jim?
Well, a 7% return, you would have to put away $380 a month, but also at age 55, this is really bad, At age 55, at a 7% rate of return, you'd have to put away $5,800 a month. So that difference in compounding is considerable, even if you're using lower rate of returns. And one thing that is often forgotten about people that are putting money in 401k programs or 403b, a lot of times I know in 401k programs, employers match the contribution of employees. I know I have a daughter-in-law that works for a defense contractor, and they will match almost 100% of what she makes up to about half of her contribution. And so if she puts the maximum contribution into the 401k program, they put in less. But, you know, there are a lot of companies that they have a 401k program as their main pension program for all their employees, and they either match 25%, 50%, or 100%. Now, think about that, Kathleen. If you're putting, let's say, we'll take the 7% rate of return. Well, if you're only earning 7% on that $380 that you're going to put away over a long period of time, it's actually going to be higher than that, because what happens if the money you put in the first year or each year, the new money you're putting in, your employer is matching you dollar for dollar. In other words, you're getting 100% rate of return on your money with new money going in, and then the money later on after the first year earns a 7%. So the 7% number may be low. So that's the thing that is so attractive here. It's not just the time and how little you have to start out with, but also many companies are giving employees incentives with matching contributions. So it's not just the money you are personally putting aside, it's the money that the company is also adding to your own contribution. Think of what that does over a 30 or 40 year working career. The numbers are considerable.
Jim, I think probably one of the things you and Veronica might be talking about later is this whole idea of the employer match and how many people are sort of neglecting that part of their salary by not putting money away in the 401k. So they're essentially throwing away free money, free return. It's almost like saying, don't cut me that bonus check, boss. I don't really need it. So definitely having your boss match definitely increases the return on your 401k investment overall. And certainly I think something else too is that if you're someone who's not disciplined enough to put away the same amount every month manually, we talked a while ago about how brainless is painless, that basically if you set up an automated contribution plan to your 401k, you start some dollar cost averaging into your 401k, you'll end up making contributions without ever even feeling it. It'll never hit your paycheck. You won't even know it's there. You won't be spending it. You won't feel the agony you can of making that, cutting a check every month. It'll just happen behind the scenes. You won't even know what's happening. You start doing a dollar cost averaging program, and sometimes you'll be buying when the market's high. Sometimes you'll be buying when the market's low, but it all happens automatically, and you just are able to keep saving without really having to put a whole lot of thought into it from a day-to-day basis.
Now, the next thing I want to address, Kathleen, is I'm sure a lot of young people listening to this program, and if, you know, your parents, you're having your children listen or your grandchildren, they're thinking, oh, yeah, that's great. Jim's saying that. But, you know, let's get realistic here. We just got married. We're trying to save up money for a down payment on a house. Or, you know, you're married and you have a couple of kids, and the most important thing is you want to get, you know, a college education. And I understand that. And usually what happens if through the planning process, it's called prioritization. So let's say a young couple starting out, let's take a couple, let's say 25 years old, they get married, and their first goal is they want to save money to have enough money for a down payment on a house. So let's take their savings, and let's say they're putting aside $100 a month, $1,000 a month, five, whatever it is. So what you do is you allocate a percentage. You might say, okay, until we get goal number one, which is the down payment for the house, 70% of our money is going to go towards a down payment on a house. 20% is going to go towards, let's say, putting money aside for our children's education, and 10% is going to go for retirement. Now, once you get the money that you have put aside for your house, and now you're a homeowner, okay, now we can allocate the payment to your next goal, which is, let's say, 80% towards college education, 20% towards retirement. Once you have enough money aside for college, then it's 100%. And here's the point I like to make. If you're starting out trying to save up enough money for, let's say, a down payment on a house. You have kids or newborn children. You want to put money aside for their college. And you know, the earlier you start putting the money for college, the better off or the sooner you're going to achieve that objective. The point at age 25 at a 10% rate of return over a long period of time. Remember, you got 40 years ahead of you till you hit age 65. It's $160. And that's the point, Kathleen. You can work $160 into your budget, let's say between a husband and wife working, if you do it early. Because at age 25, it's only $160. It's $40 a week. It's less than $8 a day. I mean, just cutting out a couple lattes at Starbucks would pay for that. And imagine this, Kathleen. If both husband and wife work and they both put $160 a month into a 401k program with matching contributions, then we're talking a couple $1 million at retirement, not just $1 million. So a lot of people are saying, yeah, this is great, but you know, my first priority is a house. Then next would be college for my children. And because we're looking at retirement, let's say at age 25, well, that's 40 years out there. You're not even thinking about it. But what I do want you to think about, can you afford $160? And let's put it this way, if you can, you're going to be a millionaire.
I think this brings us back to something we keep hammering home over and over again, Jim, the budget, the horrible B word, the budget. When people are thinking about planning for retirement or some of these other goals, their first project really is to figure out how much excess do we actually have in our budget to put toward these goals. That's kind of the first challenge, is figuring out how much, you know, wiggle room do we have to play with in our budget, and can we make more wiggle room to make these goals happen faster? So again, if you're thinking about planning for retirement, you want to hit that $1 million goal, the first thing you got to do is say, do I actually have room for that money in my budget? And if I don't, what can I do to make that money appear in my budget? What can I sacrifice to make that money be available for my savings goals? So again, that horrible word budget just going to keep cropping up, Jim.
Well, I want to move on to something, you know, as we leave accumulating, a couple key things. It's time, which time means you have a period of time that your money compounds. And over a long period of time, compound interest has been called one of the seventh wonders of the world. The second is rate of return. And just remember, if you're putting money into a 401k program and you're getting matching contributions from your employer, let's say you get 100% matching contribution. I mean, how many people would throw away a bonus? That's 100% rate of return on your money the first year you put it into the program. Imagine if you're getting 100% bonus return every year you put new money into your plan. Imagine over a 40-year period what that money is going to amount to. And for most people that are starting out a family where they have goals of maybe, you know, eventually owning their own home, putting money aside for their kids' education, when you start out early, you don't have to have a large amount of money to put aside to end up becoming a millionaire. And that's what I wanted to get to as we leave this segment. And now I want to move on to our next segment that is also related. We talked about compounding in this first part on compounding money over time so you can accumulate and have a nice nest egg when you retire.
So let's say that you were a good saver, you were a good investor, you've reached age 65, you got $1 million now. We've talked a lot about the value of compounding return over time. Now that you're in retirement, you have to start taking distributions and living off this money you've accumulated. Now you've got a different set of compounding to be worried about. You've got compounding inflation, and how can you counteract that compounding effects of inflation with compounding income? So, Jim, why don't we talk a little bit about ways that an income stream that can compound over time can help you stay ahead of inflation with your retirement assets?
Well, what I wanted to do, Kathleen, I just took a retirement income, and you could, you know, you can double these figures or multiply it times 1.5. I just said, what if somebody was making $50,000 a year, or that's what it cost them to live in retirement? Now, obviously, if you're in California or New York, it's going to cost more than that. If you're in Texas and Florida, it might be less. But I took $50,000, and I took various inflation rates. Now, statistically, what we do know from actuarial tables provided by the government on Social Security and life insurance companies, a husband and wife, both age 65, between the two of them will spend 25 years in retirement. So I took $50,000 and I took a 3% inflation rate, a 4% inflation rate, and a 6% inflation rate. Now, I'm not going to go through every single number, but let's put it this way. It starts to become significant. You wouldn't think 3,000 or a 3% inflation rate. In 5 years, if you were spending $50,000 a year at a 3% inflation rate, you would need almost $58,000 in 5 years. At a 4% inflation rate, you're going to need $61,000. And at a 6% inflation rate, you're going to need $67,000. Now, let's fast forward because these numbers begin to really become dramatic the further out we go. 10 years at a 3% inflation rate, you're $50,000. You're going to need $67,000 at a 3% inflation rate, $74,000 in 10 years at a 4% inflation rate, and almost $90,000 at a 6% inflation rate. Now, let's go even further, another 10 years, because this is when the cost really begin to come home. 20 years of inflation rates, and imagine the medical cost that you run into in your later years in retirement. At a 4% inflation rate, if you're spending $50,000 today, $50,000 today at a 3% inflation rate in 20 years, Kathleen, you're going to need $90,000. At a 4% inflation rate, you're going to need $110,000. And at a 6% inflation rate, you're going to need $160,000. And I don't even want to scare you what you're going to need if it's 25 years. So you can see even small rates of inflation, a 3% inflation rate, a 4% inflation rate, or even a 6, really start to compound and add up over a period of time. And this is something we have run into over the years with clients where they start out, they put everything in fixed income, and all of a sudden they come to us and they go, you know what? This isn't working. We're penny pinching. We're not taking the 2 trips a year. It's got down to 1. So, you know, one thing that happens so often, Kathleen, that we see that, you know, you have these cookie cutter programs that say, well, you know, you're age 65, you need to have 60 to 70% of your money in fixed income, and you need to only have 30% in stocks. Well, the problem is if your entire budget is inflating at 3%, if you have a fixed pension or you have, let's say, a bond portfolio that's fixed, unfortunately, how are you going to get that extra income? As I mentioned, at a 4% inflation rate, you know, if you're spending $50,000 today, in 10 years, you're going to need almost $75,000. And in 20 years, you're going to need $110,000. So what do you have in your portfolio that is going to help you take care of these inflationary costs or meet your standard of living and lifestyle? And especially today where you have, for example, 2-year treasury notes are less than 0.2%. A 10-year treasury note is 1.6%. Another way of looking at it is if I took the $1 million and put it in, let's say, treasuries at a 10-year treasury note at 1.6%, that's going to be $16,000 today. 10 years from now, when your cost of living has gone up more than 50%, it's still going to be $16,000.
I think this is a really good point to make, Jim, because it points out how certain types of investment vehicles make sense for certain different types of environments and certain specific needs. And I think in this case, if you look at the $1 million that you have available to you, and let's just say that you're in a situation where the inflation rate is growing at 4%, you need an income stream that's going to be growing at least that much to be able to keep up with that inflationary rate. And there are a few investments that do that, Jim. So why don't we discuss a few of the investments that actually will grow their income at a rate that will help keep you up with inflation?
Well, Kathleen, you know, there's a couple of ways you can go about it. And the best way to get some compound rate of return is to invest in an asset, whether it's real estate that's a rental where you can raise every year, you have the ability to raise rents, although in the real estate crisis, that didn't always happen. But something that has the ability, one of the best investments of increasing income is to invest in blue chip stocks. Now, there's 2 ways you can go. You can go in dividend paying stocks that have a higher dividend, but they don't increase those dividends as much. And a good example of that would be, for example, a utility stock. I can get a 4% rate of return, 4.5% rate of return on a good old-fashioned utility stock, but utilities only increase their dividends 4 or 5%. Or on the other hand, I can go into something like, let's say, good old Dow Jones Industrial stock, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average is increasing their dividends at 9-10%, but more importantly, the dividend yield on the Dow is 2.4%. So what I did is I just took a level of income and just say that you're getting $20,000 a year from dividends, $30,000 a year from dividends, and $40,000. And I said, okay, what if those dividends, let's take a balance between the S&P and the Dow. Now, the Dow has been increasing their dividends at close to 10% a year. The S&P, less so, because there are a lot more companies in the Dow that are paying dividends, because the Dow are more mature companies compared to, let's say, some of the faster growing companies you would find in the S&P. So I took a figure of 8%. And here's the remarkable thing. At an 8% dividend increase, if you had $20,000 of income coming from dividends, Kathleen, at 8% in 10 years, that $20,000 would produce $43,000 in dividends. In 20 years, it would produce $93,000 in dividends. And so you can see there a remarkable difference. You're going to have that ability to have, just as compounding worked for you to your advantage in accumulating assets, it can also work to your advantage in providing for retirement in terms of having your income compounding. So most people and advisors all know about, oh, you need to put money aside, as we talked about in the first segment, in saving for retirement, so to have those assets compound, but they never think about income compounding, and that's something that you can do with dividends.
Let's actually break this down to a real-world example, Jim. Let's actually take a look at a specific company and say, if we invested the entire portfolio in this company, which we would never recommend, by the way, but let's just say for argument's sake, we invested the entire portfolio in this particular company. Let's just take Chevron, for example, or Exxon. Exxon's paying about a 3% dividend right now. If I start investing in that company with my full $1 million, it's currently paying me a 3% dividend. That dividend grows at a 10% rate every year. In 5 years, that company is going to be paying me a 4.8% dividend. In 20 years, a 20.2% dividend if it keeps growing at 10% per year. And in 25 years, if I keep investing in Chevron or Exxon and it keeps growing its dividend year over year, 32.5% dividend yield coming from that same exact company. I don't think your fixed income is going to do that for you.
No, and let me just explain for our listeners, when Kathleen said over 32% in 25 years, what she's referring to is the original $1 million of capital. So if I had $1 million and I invested in Exxon today at a 3% dividend yield, I'd be getting, let's say, $30,000 a year. However, because Exxon, which has increased its dividend every single year, actually, they just bumped it up again just recently. The next quarterly dividend is actually going from 57 cents to 63 cents. They just increased that dividend 11%. But we're using the 10% example. But over the last 5 years, they've been increasing their dividend at over 10%. Over 5 years, it's been 10.25%. Over 3 years, it's almost 11%. Over the last 12 months, it's been 21%. So that original dividend of 3%, if it keeps going up on your original $1 million, in 10 years, you're getting 8%. 20 years, you're getting 20%. In 25 years, you're getting 32% on that original $1 million. And let's break it down in terms of money, what that means. In 10 years, instead of getting $30,000 from Exxon, you're going to be getting $80,000 from Exxon. In 20 years, instead of getting $30,000 your first year from Exxon, Exxon's going to be paying you $200,000 or $325,000 in year 25. And Kathleen, it's one of the easiest ways I know to take care of inflation for anybody that's retired, because I think anybody listening to this podcast that's retired or getting close to retirement would have to look back over the last 10 years, where they spent money, what's happened to their gas bills, their utility bills, what they're paying for their insurance premiums, what they're paying for food, their cable bill, their phone bill. All the things that we need to live on a daily basis are going up every single year. So when you retire, if you've been successful, you started early, you invested wisely, you put that money aside, sometimes people get to retirement, they forget how they got there, and they change their investment strategy. So it's not just the fact that compounding works for your favor, in your favor, when you're trying to build up wealth for retirement. It also works in your favor when you turn it to compounding your income during your retirement years.
I think this is a really good point, Jim, because I think back, for example, when we started the Social Security program, average lifespan after starting Social Security wasn't that long, a few years perhaps. So really, inflation wasn't that big of a deal if you're in retirement. But now most people do live 20 to 25 years in retirement. So inflation and the compounding effects of inflation really have to be taken into account. So you're right, Jim. When you're in the accumulation phase, you want to make compounding rates of return work in your favor. And then when you're planning a stream of income in retirement, you want to make sure that compounding dividend yield or compounding income streams work in your favor at that point as well. And I'm sure, as you'll be talking later on with Veronica Dagger about 401k investing, I'm sure this is a topic you and she will be discussing as well, is making smart, wise choices in terms of investing in your 401k. Like you said, start early, invest wisely, and stay disciplined. Coming up next, Veronica Dagger's interview with Jim Poplava about 401k boo-boos.
Joining us next on the program is Veronica Dagger from the Wall Street Journal. And Veronica, you wrote a piece back early in April that I just loved. It was called Big 401 Mistakes and How You Can Avoid Them. You know, we think of 401ks, people put money into them, but there are a lot of things that they're doing that may not be right that could affect their long-term outcome for retirement. And the first one I want to address that you did in your article is under or over-contributing to a 401k. Let's begin with that.
Thanks, Jim. Yeah, there's a lot of mistakes folks make, and this under and over-contributing is probably the biggest one. First, even before then, actually, some people aren't even contributing at all. And so that's number one. If you're not contributing, start as much as you can as soon as possible, if that's possible for you. But if you can only contribute a small amount, just get going, get started, because there's never going to be the perfect time to do it. So that's the first thing. Under-contributing is another very common thing that the folks do. They miss out on the power of compounding if they don't have enough money in the market. And so I think this is one thing that people are afraid to do, is that they're not sure how much they should contribute, or they're afraid of, for whatever reason. But this can also cause mistakes because they might miss out on an employer match. You know, if you're not contributing at least up into your employer match, you're leaving money on the table. And that's a big mistake, because that money will add up later on when you need it later for retirement.
Veronica, you're hitting on a key point. Imagine your boss coming up to you and saying, Veronica, I like to give you a 5% bonus. You're doing a good job. How many people would turn away a bonus offered by their employer? Yet, when you're contributing to a 401k program, let's say in the example of your article, you're putting in 5% of your salary and your boss matches it by 5%. If you're not doing that, you're walking away from bonus money that's free.
Right. It's a huge benefit to walk away from. You know, everybody wants a raise, but that's a raise right there. You really want to take advantage of it. So, you know, and even say you're contributing 3% now and you bump up your contribution to 5%, you know, give it a try for, you know, a couple of weeks, because you may not even really realize so much the difference. I mean, you'll see it in your bottom line amount you're taking home, but at the same time, that there's a good chance that maybe you were using that money to spend on things you don't need anyway. So this will automatically take the money out of your paycheck. You can save more, and you probably, you know, a 2% increase in how much you're putting away each pay period, you're probably not going to feel. So, if you need to make incremental moves like that, making small changes to your contribution rate, you can do that. I mean, there's 401k plans that allow you, you know, you can set up this sort of automatic increase. So you can say, hey, every month or every year that I'm in this plan, increase my contribution 1 or 2%. You can specify how you want that auto increase to happen, but that can happen automatically. And that way you don't have to think about increasing your contribution.
Yeah, and it's not just that you're also walking away from your employer matching, which is like walking away from a bonus, but what about the tax deduction that you're getting? Because that's all done pre-tax.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you may not think of it now, but in April, when you go get your taxes done and you see, hey, I'm not going to have to pay as much taxes, or maybe I won't have to pay at all because I contributed more to my 401k plan, that's a really nice news to get from your accountant. That's another benefit of contributing.
Let me bring up your first point was underfunding. Let's talk about overfunding, because I have actually seen situations because of tax planning and employer matching where you'll have a couple or an individual and they'll max, they want to put as much as they can in their 401k program and they have nothing for financial emergencies. So, you know, if they have to go buy new tires for the car, a new battery, all of a sudden they start taking loans out or they put money on credit cards. So let's talk about also making sure that you have a cushion personally in case those financial emergencies crop up.
That's a really good point. It's so important to have an emergency fund in case those emergencies do come up. You know, so many advisors I spoke to said they have seen this. They've seen people best intentions of, you know, I want to max out my 401k, but they don't have anything saved for a rainy day. So before you start maxing out your 401k, get an emergency fund together for yourself, something in a very liquid instrument, you know, even if it's just in your bank account, at least. Some people say 3 to 6 months. I've heard some other advisors say 6 to 12 months of living expenses. It really depends, I guess, on how secure you feel your job is. I would err on the side of having more saved for emergency because you never know. There's things like, you know, your car could break down, or what can be pretty common is a medical emergency. And medical emergencies, even if you have insurance, can get pretty costly. And so you don't want to underestimate the need to help yourself, or in some cases, it's also helping a relative. You might have a relative unexpectedly get laid off, or you might end up having to pay, you know, help them out with their rent. You never know. So having extra money on hand is helpful in case you get put in that situation. And you can always boost your 401k contribution later.
Yeah, and especially, if, let's say, over your career as your salary increases or you get cost of living increases. I want to move on to something else, too, and that is ignoring the fees. You talk about one of the biggest misperceptions clients have about their 401k plan is that it's a free benefit. But, you know, there's fees and all kinds of costs associated with it.
That's right. That's right. There's no such thing as a free benefit when it comes to a 401k, although a lot of people don't realize that. There's costs buried within the investment expenses of the funds and the plan, and that can really drastically eat into your account balance in the long run. Now, some people aren't aware of these fees, or they're not really thinking about it because they think it's a free benefit. And there is more disclosure now by companies because of some Department of Labor regulations. But you always want to see if you can get a good investment, you know, obviously with a lower cost to you. And so some advisors are saying, you know, within your 401k plan, take a look not only at the quality of the investments, but also look at the fees that are associated with that. And if you have two equally good investments, but one of them has a lower fee, you might want to pick the one with the lower fee. So for example, you might want to consider picking an index fund. These typically have lower costs than some actively managed mutual funds, which are typically in plans as well. And so that's something to keep an eye on. Also, if you find that your fees are really high or you have a question about it, you're not sure, you know, talk to your employer. You might want to go to your benefits department. And some people will complain and say these plan costs are too high.
What about something that I've seen, and there's been a number of articles you've written about this in the past as well, and that is taking out a loan from a 401k plan to, let's say, pay off a car loan, credit card debts, because you think, oh, you know, I'm taking this money out, I'm paying it myself. What's wrong with that?
You know, it's great in theory, but a lot of folks I spoke to said, advisors I speak to said, it rarely works out in that people say, oh, I'm going to pay off this debt, but for whatever reason, they don't do it. So, and if they don't use the loan that they took to pay off the debt, not only are they left with the debt, but they're also, if they don't pay back that loan in time, they're left with penalties and taxes, and your money's been out of the market that whole time as well. You know, you're missing out on potential market gains and compounding while that money that you're taking as a loan is out of the market. And I think it's a better financial practice, instead of using your 401k as a line of credit, essentially, which can be dangerous, I think it's better serve for folks to pare down your current lifestyle. Make some sacrifices, and nobody likes to make sacrifices, I know, but maybe don't go out to eat as often. Don't spend so much on things that you don't necessarily need. Maybe you want them, but you don't need them. Maybe it's taking a cheaper vacation this year. Whatever you need to do, scale back instead of borrowing against something that's going to provide your financial security, hopefully, down the road.
I want to move on to something that I see. I consider this to be a major mistake that's being made in 401k programs because as a result of the 2007-2009 recession, financial crisis, a lot of people got frightened by the stock market. That was the second bear market they'd experienced in a decade. People are going into 100% in bonds. They're sitting in cash. I have run into a lot of individuals who have been in cash in their 401k programs for the last 4 or 5 years. And, you know, you think about this, Veronica, you know, if I'm 25 and each month, you know, we used to teach when I was doing financial planning about dollar cost averaging. So every month you're putting money from your 401k, if the market's down that month, your money or contribution is buying more shares in the mutual fund. And what you care about 30, 40 years from now is how many shares you own, not where the market is today.
Yeah, you know, and when you said that the point of people keeping cash in their 401k just makes you want to cringe also because the fees, you're not getting that investment for free also. There's a fee that the 401k provider, you know, is charging on keeping that cash in the account. I mean, you could do it in the bank probably. You could leave, put your cash, you're going to keep cash around, put it in the bank. That way you don't have to pay a fee on it most likely. But yeah, you're missing out on the market and you're taking a short-term view if you keep everything in cash. You really, you know, it's good to have an emergency fund and that you can have in cash. But the stuff in your 401k, you really want to take a longer term investment perspective. It's not, you know, there's a, you know, if you're not retiring in any, you know, the next year or two, you want to take a multi-year horizon perspective to this money. And so I think it's important to really carefully look at your asset allocation and understand what you're owning, or understand the investment choices in your plan, make an educated decision on what to invest in, and periodically look at your asset allocation, look at those investment choices that you've selected, and see if they're still working for you every year. I think it's a good idea, at least, at the very least, to have a sort of a yearly checkup on your investments, see how they're doing, see if they still meet your needs. And you might want to depending on market performance, you might want to rebalance if necessary. Another mistake, you know, like you had just mentioned, you know, people feeling nervous, understandably. We've been through a lot. We've seen so much volatility. People have, you know, 2008 is still fresh in people's minds. But putting everything in the bond market 100%, there's also a risk to that. Look, no investment is without risk. And especially bonds, long-term bonds, are risky for folks. And I think a lot of people in America may not realize the risk, especially now associated with long-term bonds, when interest rates go up. They're holding long-term bonds, their investment's not going to be worth as much as, or if anything, that they think it is. So that they could have more risk than they realize. Whether you own stocks or you own bonds, you really want to have a sense of what your exposure is. And you want to make sure you're comfortable with that and not caught surprised when you open your next 401k statement and say, like, what happened?
You know, something else that you talk about that's risk, a lot of individuals have 401k programs where they work for a publicly traded corporation, and there's the option to have company stock. I can remember in the 90s, the go-go stock was, Enron.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the danger. Even though you enjoy the company, you may think a lot about it. I mean, everybody thought Enron was a wonderful company. They were featured in Fortune magazine as one of the top performing stellar companies. A year later, we found out there was a lot of investment fraud. And think of what happened to the employees at, let's say, Enron or WorldCom that had everything in the company stock. So let's talk about, you know, a more reasonable amount that should be allocated to, let's say, the company stock for the company you work for.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Some people really lost their shirts with that, Enron, WorldCom, and can name countless other companies. So some advisors I spoke to say invest no more than 10% of your portfolio into your employer stock. Some advisors, though, frankly, say don't invest anything. You already have a lot of exposure, given the fact that they're your employer. They're paying your weekly salary or biweekly salary, and so you already have a lot invested in this company, technically. So you want to be as diversified as possible. And so you also, so you've got your human capital working for this company. Put your financial capital someplace else, just in case you're better protected in case of something freak happens. Hopefully it won't happen. But people's instinct is to invest in what they own, what they know, and that's good to an extent, but you may be overestimating how much you know about your company. Look, unless you're in the corporate office, unless you're the CEO or the president or the CFO, even those folks may not know as much as they think they know in terms of the overall health of the company. And so just because you've worked there 20 years doesn't mean you've a real insight into the inner workings of the company's financial state. And I think that's important to remember.
I want to move on to something else because we're talking about retirement planning here. We've been talking about putting money aside for, let's say, a 401k plan so you have a pension when you retire. I want to talk about something else that comes up in retirement, and that is a subject that is somewhat difficult sometimes for parents, and that is to talk about with their children, their heirs, how much money they stand to inherit. It could often be a subject fraught with emotional landmines for parents, some of whom may feel guilty about having money and don't want to ruin their children's worth, especially wealthy families, and other families that are saying, hey, you know, we're spending part of our principal. Sorry, you know, the millions you thought we had, we're not going to have that when you retire. So let's talk about how do you approach this kind of dreaded topic. Sometimes it's just often avoided. I see many cases where kids are actually surprised when mom and dad have to find out either one, how little they have, or to discover how much they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I think most of the time, very wealthy families avoid this topic. It's just an awkward conversation, especially to your point. It's like nobody wants to raise an entitled kid. And so they're afraid of, you know, when should I tell them? How should I tell them? And so that's what this article got into. A lot of also wealthy people are very private and feel like even discussing this with their children is sharing too much information. So there's a lot of emotional issues. There's a lot of trust issues wrapped up in this. And so, you know, no one size fits all. Every family is different. But one thing a lot of the advisors I spoke to agree on is to tell heirs gradually. You know, you want to, the amount of wealth to be distributed in the maturity level of the heirs is going to vary dramatically from family to family. So, you know, when you tell them, though, you typically don't want to do this, you know, build up to this big full disclosure and drop news on people that all of a sudden, you know, were millionaires and you're going to have to manage all this money. I know there's one advisor I spoke to. Their client all of a sudden told their 14-year-old son he was going to inherit, you know, multi-million dollars, and he was going to have all this responsibility. And the poor kid was actually, you know, he was overwhelmed by it. He just felt burdened by it, and it really affected him psychologically. So I think gradually telling heirs as they grow up, kind of the gradual reveal. Some people say to start with a family mission statement, which clarifies the family's values regarding money, and hold regular family meetings to communicate them and disclose that. And let them know how this wealth was created. You know, let them know the money didn't just come out of thin air. This, we actually worked for this, or even if we inherited this money, someone at some point worked for this. So I think that's really important to tell kids and to tell young adults as well. I think it's also, you know, if Junior comes home one day and says, you know, Mom, are we rich? You know, it seems like we are. My friends say we are. I think it's important to not lie. I think it's supposed to say, like, yes, we are. You know, we've got a blessings of, you know, a good bit of money, but we're richer in whom we are in terms of a family. And hence, as a result, we do have these blessings. It is our responsibility to help some other people. So I think planting that seed as early as you can, it's like we have this wealth, but there's a responsibility to help other people. It doesn't come without a cost. Because we have so much, we have a responsibility to give some of that away and make someone else's life better.
What about, let's say you're contemplating doing that. You know, you've done your estate plan and you thought, okay, we need to bring the kids in on what we're doing. And especially if they might be, for example, successor trustees on a living trust that mom and dad have. What if, I guess maybe the kids are not ready to handle this or they're not ready to know? What do you do then?
That's a tough one. It's really tough. You know, it really varies by the family, but some people will say, you know, if you're in a position where you can bring in an outside advisor or actually a coach, there's some coaches out there, some mentors out there who can take, presumably, if we're talking about a young adult, you can take that heir and teach them about financial, the basics of budgeting, the basics of the philanthropy, the basics of the stock market. Teach them to gradually learn how to handle the money, because you don't want to, if they're not ready to understand or they have a spending problem or unfortunately an addiction, something like that, you don't want to give them all this money. You want to give them the tools to handle that first. And so in order to do that, you might need to bring in an outside mentor, because quite frankly, no matter what the kid's age, they probably don't want to hear from their parents. I mean, you do need to tell your and educate your kids to an extent, but you also sometimes an outside voice will have more authority. So you might want to enlist the help of someone from the outside, whether a mentor or a coach, like I said, to teach them about their inheritance. So that's one way to handle it.
In terms of, are there any prescribed things that maybe parents should do? Like, say, for example, you take a wealthy family, and let's say the kids may not be as well off. They stand to inherit a substantial sum of money about, you know, maybe getting the kids educated in terms of finances, in terms of the markets. Because, you know, let's say, for example, the kids basically are struggling, they have a house, and all of a sudden they stand to come into $1 million or more apiece. I mean, a lot of people, and you've seen this, Veronica, where you hear about these people that win the lottery and they get all this money and they end up being broke.
Right, right. The windfall usually isn't the greatest thing for most people financially. They usually just don't know how to handle it. And so one of the things you can do, if say your adult children, say they're in their 20s and you want to tell them more about the inheritance, you want to give them a chance to sort of experiment with a smaller amount of money, maybe you help them with a down payment for their home. Maybe that's the first way. And that can be sort of a test. That can be a way to help them get established, help them get in part of their inheritance, but also teach them. It can be a teaching, learning opportunity to learn about mortgages, learn about handling, you know, monthly bills that are due on the home, whatever that needs to be done. That can be a way to get them involved, but in a gradual way. It's the whole idea of the mentoring again. Some advisors I spoke to did a family bank with heirs who were there in their 20s and 30s. And basically, the family, the siblings had to work together to manage a small pool of money. And they make decisions on maybe who, you know, where that money goes, what investments. They did research on different types of investments and how to make a recommendation to the rest of the family. That's a way to teach them as well. Some people do that with philanthropy too. Each family member has a responsibility to look into different charities, research them, and present them to the family, and then the family will make some sort of grant, whether if they have a foundation or what have you, to the charity. So it's sort of a gradual teaching, mentoring process to get heirs ready for handling all this money one day. So it's just not one day that they've got, you know, $50 million in their lap. They gradually learned how to handle, you know, a million, you know, when they were 20, and then, you know, so on and so forth. I'm just picking numbers here, but you get the point.
What about something, Veronica, like a co-trustee, like a corporate trustee that could maybe guide the kids? So let's say the parents are looking at their children and, you know, let's say they're just not educated in the area of finance or the financial markets, of having, let's say, a corporate trustee that can maybe aid the kids when they come into that inheritance. What about that idea?
Yeah. Some people do that, and that has been helpful for some families. I mean, that person can serve as a mentor to that younger generation as well. you know, there can be some issues with that too. Well, you know, when you get into trust, that's a whole other issue. But, you know, sometimes if you are using a corporate trustee or selecting a certain trust company, you know, there's some advisors who will say you want to make sure the dynamics of the people working with the heirs are the right fit in terms of the chemistry. You also sometimes want to make sure that there's not too many shackles on that trust, so they're not, the heir isn't being policed and told what to do with every single dime, because otherwise they're not going to learn anything about the money anyway. If you're mandating that they can only spend it on, you know, X, Y, and Z, then that may limit how much they are able to handle this new wealth, because they have such tight checks and balances on them. Granted, you know, if someone has an addiction, that's a whole other conversation. But yeah, a trustee could definitely be helpful for some families, for sure.
So, Veronica, as we conclude here, if we were to draw some conclusions, beginning with, let's say, the 401k, make sure you're not under-contributing or over-contributing. In other words, make sure you take advantage of the full tax deduction that you can put away, and especially matching contributions. But on the other hand, you don't want to put so much money in your 401k that you have no personal savings.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other things you talked about, taking or making loans from your 401k, ignoring the fees, and more importantly, ignoring proper allocation, especially given your age. The other thing we talked about is the delicate subject of talking to kids about their inheritance, which can raise a few eyebrows.
For sure.
Well, listen, Veronica, I want to thank you for joining us here on the Lifetime Income. And by the way, folks, if you're listening to this podcast, you can follow Veronica's work under the Personal Finance section of the Wall Street Journal. Veronica, thanks for joining us, and have yourself a great weekend.
You too. Thanks for having me, Jim.
Well, that concludes my interview with Veronica Dagher from the Wall Street Journal. She writes a lot of great articles on personal planning. If you're a subscriber to the Wall Street Journal, either in paper form or online, be sure to look under the personal finance section, and you'll find Veronica's articles there touching upon a lot of important issues, as we just covered. For example, discussing inheritance with children. Those can be some very delicate moments, as well as her article there talked about making mistakes in 401k programs. But that concludes the interview. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Lifetime Income series. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.